Hello and welcome to Culture with me, Robert Bound, where today we're taking the new issue of Monocle out for a spin. The 104th edition of the mag has just hit newsstands and the doorsteps of subscribers, and over the next half an hour we're going to explore the culture pages with the people who helped to put it together. We'll find out about the firm that set the scene for the US's best-loved comedy show, Saturday Night Live. We'll speak to our TV columnist about what sort of car shows will be keeping us from screeching off the road for the rest of the year, and we'll speak to the woman who's trying to keep Toronto's reputation for being live music heaven well and truly intact. It's hundreds of pages of magazines squashed into just 29 minutes of radio. Maybe we should do a show about how we do that. Stick around, why don't you? So first, let's turn to the lead story and let's go to New York City and take the hand of Marissa Mazria-Katz, who found when researching a different story about the Brooklyn Navy Yard that the best thing about it is a singular company with a very specific job. Stiegelbauer are set designers and set builders for stage and screens, both silver and small, but the meat and potatoes of their work is for the late-night satirical sketch show Saturday Night Live, the show that launched the careers of John Belushi, Chevy Chase, Bill Murray, Will Ferrell and Ben Stiller, and currently enjoys Alec Baldwin killing it, in popular parlance, as Donald Trump. So, Stiegelbauer built Oval Offices, UFO crash sites, New York street scenes and speakeasies. In fact, anything the writers write, they build. And Marissa, fresh from Stiegelbauer's aircraft hangar of a place, joins us now. Marissa, welcome to the programme. Now tell us, this is a huge, almost daunting space that Stiegelbauer's have in the Brooklyn Navy Yard. What's the first thing that hits you when you walk through the door there?
I mean, I think it's exactly what you just said. It's so enormous. And to live in a city like New York, where you really don't see space like in one concentrated mass, right? Like you, maybe Grand Central Station, but there aren't public spaces that are that open and grand and airy. And it's actually like weirdly has light coming in. And
sounds so like a great place for a party, actually, as well, right? I mean, they could...
Totally.
You and I think the same, obviously.
It's breathtaking, to be honest.
Yeah, it's quite an awe-inspiring place. And I guess, depending upon the day of the week and the time of the month and all the rest of it, it's either chock full of stuff or it's crazy busy while they prepare stuff. So you obviously went on a couple of occasions to write this story for us, Marissa. And you went on the occasion that they just got the scripts from the Saturday Night Live script writers. And then as soon as it gets emailed through or whatever, suddenly all hell breaks loose, right? Describe that moment when they start working and what the shift is that they put in, these guys.
To be honest, I was fast asleep when they started working because most of the city is. I mean, they get it at around 1 o'clock in the morning, and that's when sort of the process kicks off. And then 3 o'clock in the morning, you have the foreman or the person who comes in and kind of orchestrates what the teams will be like. And these teams are subdivided to work on all the different sets that Saturday Night Live script writers have come up with. It's an incredible operation, and it's almost would be 24 hours if it wasn't for the incredible precision with which they know how to run this operation. They get there quite early in the morning, the day that the script comes through, but then they do actually go home. It isn't a full-time operation. They know exactly how to prepare and get things out so that they are delivered uptown, which is where the studios are in Rockefeller Center, and they're done in a way that it's like, it's almost like clockwork. But it does start at around 1 o'clock in the morning, then 3 o'clock in the morning, there's another shift. And then around 6, 7 o'clock in the morning, a lot of the people that come in and work on it will arrive. And I came in shortly thereafter. And at that point, so much is happening. So much noise occupies the space, all the cutting and all the drilling and all the wheeling. But the thing that's so incredible about it that I love, which I feel is so, there's got such an old school vibe to this place, is that the minute lunchtime rolls around, everything stops.
I'm glad some things are sacred.
Oh, yeah. They are very serious about these breaks. And I love it because I don't feel like I ever take breaks anymore, right? I'm always like eating at my computer or on the phone while I'm doing. But here it was just like this beautiful moment where everybody collectively sat together, more or less, ate, talked, and then it was back to work, right? And that was the the sort of rhythm of the day that I was there.
Tell us about some of the organized chaos that you saw. You alluded to it there in that answer. You told us about, you know, all hell breaks loose and, you know, there's all sorts of stuff going on. So there's carpenters building physical bits of set. Presumably there's paint flying all over the place as people paint an Oval Office. Or we mentioned some of the things in the introduction to this, you know, whether they're UFO crash sites, whether they're museum buildings, whatever the thing is that Saturday Night Live is riffing on that week. What bits of what well-known buildings did you see being built while you were there?
Well, that week was the week of Bill O'Reilly. And that was kind of really exciting to see because, of course, we all are familiar with the set.
So this is the Fox News, the erstwhile Fox News presenter who was allowed to go by Fox News. So he does a very shouty talk show, right?
That was really fascinating to see. And then the other thing that they were starting to construct, right? So what you see when you walk through the halls, these sort of makeshift halls that are erected throughout the day, are kind of the bones of what will become their sets. And so it's the frames. And eventually these frames, which are familiar, like the Bill O'Reilly set, or there was a conference room that they were building, a lot of them kind of look pretty commonplace and you wouldn't be able to identify them. It's sort of like once they get up to Saturday Night Live and are set dressed, that you then kind of see all of the work that Siegelbauer has put in to create the entire atmosphere. There's a lot of aha moments when you go through Siegelbauer's. It's like, oh, there's the podium in which Sean Spicer's been speaking from, or Melissa McCarthy. You know, it's so there's a lot of recognition and there's a lot of moments where you're sort of reminded of all these classic scenes coming out of this show. Now, just to say, this show has become so important and so talked about since the president was elected. It was sort of going through a rebirth in a way. So I kind of feel that what we see in Siegelbauer's, in a way, it's sticking with a lot of people these days in terms of the amount of people that are tuning in to watch Saturday Night Live every week.
Yeah, it's a bit of a renaissance for the show, aided and abetted by an odd political situation, I suppose, in your country. So before we go, let's talk about some of the runners and riders. As we said, it's a family-owned business. Now, old Mr. Siegelbauer was there for some of your interviews, not for others. His daughter, Nicole Siegelbauer, I think at the time also 8 months pregnant with another Siegelbauer, who knows, will be a set designer, him or herself. So it's all ready to go. There is a saga kind of ready and fresh packed and ready to go here, Marissa. So tell me about the surname. Tell me about the people behind it. It's a funny job to get into, I guess.
Yeah, but it's such an incredible, you know, real American story in so much as you have this family and they started really at the bottom. So it was Mr. Siegelbauer's father who was, you know, started at the studios at NBC and then moved his way up to overseeing production design there. And then his son sort of followed in his footsteps. And I think, you know, you're seeing this really interesting legacy that they're building for themselves. And it was sort of with their daughter, it was kind of really present so much as she was very, very pregnant, but still so committed to being there and working until almost the very end, right before she gave birth, you know. So there's this really strong commitment in the family to this company that they've put together. And what is so fascinating too about this, and you often don't see this, is a lot of the people that are working with them have been there for years and years and years. So it's almost like they have this extended family as well, people that they may have worked with at NBC that came with them to work with them at Siegelbauer, the company. So you have a real love and commitment and tenderness that just feels really rare these days with everybody moving in and out of companies so quickly and changing their roles. Here you have people that have been with the Siegelbauers for decades, and the love that they have for one another, I mean, is really tremendous to see. It just didn't feel like, you know, the today. It felt like I was stepping back 30 years ago to be with all these people who are just deeply committed to the work that they were doing.
Yeah, it seems, it does seem like that. It seems like a very old school New York story, and power to you to have sniffed this one out for us, Marissa. It's a beautifully written story. The photographs, we should also say, are amazing. That's Andrew Moore's work, because this is a deeply photogenic place. I mean, obviously, the point of it is that it's telegenic in the end, so it obviously makes a very photogenic story. To step outside of the story before we go, Marissa, what do you think about the future of a company like this? So many game shows now, so many Hollywood movies and TV shows as well are done in front of a green screen, you know, a virtual reality set. These things are made of timber and painted by hand and all the rest of it. What is your prognosis for the health of a company, an august company like Stiegelbauer, do you think?
Well, I think seeing the popularity of Saturday Night Live right now and seeing how important it has become makes me feel not at all worried about their future. I think that live TV, because they do also do a lot of talk shows as well, late night TV as well. They do Jimmy Fallon. So there is a real need right now for us to have people like the Stiegelbauers create the sets that mimic the lives that we are kind of currently living within this country. I don't think there's going to be anything stopping this company from continuing to work for the foreseeable future.
That was Marissa Mazria-Katz, and read her story in this month's Monocle, all about those TV sets. Now, Toronto is well known for its thriving music scene, but that doesn't stop it from facing the same issues as many other cities, the closing of live venues. Well, one startup called Artery is trying to address this issue by turning living rooms, backyards, rooftops, bathroom walls, and any other nooks and crannies of the city they can get their mitts on into pop-up performance spaces for musicians and artists to showcase their work. Monocle's bureau chief there in Toronto, Thomas Lewis, caught up with one of Artery's co-founders, Salima Ibrahim, to find out how it's pumping life back into Toronto's art scene.
But there's my first realism. All right, I'll stop.
Artery spaces are living rooms, backyards, rooftops, these often private spaces in a city. I've hosted an opera in my bathroom, if you can believe it. We've had ballet dancers take over backyards. There's an amazing series in Toronto where poets are taking over laundromats. And so the showcases are as diverse and interesting as the community themselves. You know, the creative life of our cities are often invisible and hard to access. And so often we're only invited to connect with artists or creators across an orchestra pit. So the essential idea of Artery is that there is room for more intimate experiences and also experiments to perform bluegrass on a stoop, or think of your rooftop as a place where a poet can, you know, try out some lines. And so the basic idea is not new, right? Mozart played in living rooms and, you know, Harlem rent parties in the 1920s. But often these performances were limited to the creative communities in which they existed. So what Artery is doing is we are hopefully putting all of this in a platform where more people can access these experiences, but hopefully we can inspire more hosts and artists to connect with each other.
In terms of, you know, live performance in Toronto, that feels like a big staple of sort of the cultural life of the city, and has been for some time. There are sort of, you know, slightly worrying stories coming out. You know, Toronto is a city that's developing so quickly. Live music pubs, for example, have been closing at a pretty alarming rate at the start of the year, at least. Lots of very treasured names and treasured venues too. You know, where does Artery fit in that? Is there a case, whether it's sort of a direct response or not, to, you know, the arts being fairly nimble, you know, the arts being able to sort of flourish in an unexpected place?
So I think we're all alarmed, right? Live music venues and what some of these great venues in Toronto that are unfortunately closing, the loss of them is significant. And what Artery is doing is certainly offering more opportunities and spaces for live music, but I think they're very, very different experiences. I think we can all sort of lament, we need a diversity of cultural experiences and access to live music. I mean, the big difference with Artery is that we're saying when you remove the orchestra pit, when you remove the stage, what you have left is connection. And our community is really a community that's, it's a co-creation. These aren't passive experiences. If you're in an audience of 20 people at an artery showcase, or you're performing to 20 people, or you're hosting 20 people now in your living room, every single person in that room matters and co-creates the experience. And so I think that we're offering a different way of organizing things, but as a whole, any way in which we can sort of support the arts at a larger level, I look at sort of the last 7 years and sort of the bar venue model. The way that has been organized is that it obviously has depended obviously on alcohol sales. There's a lot of middlemen, bars, bookers, and agents. And so I think that if we take a step back, you know, the way culture always existed and spread was in living rooms and private spaces. I mean, chamber music comes from chambers. And so, you know, as much as people like to sort of say, what we're doing is a revolution, it's really a counter-revolution. And we're just connecting people together.
You know, as it grows, as you sort of work to sort of make it grow, is there a model, say, almost like, say, Jane's Walks, for example, springs to mind, you know, whereas, you know, people are given the initiative to go and do it. You know, how does that match with, say, the Artery brand, which is, you know, becoming, you know, which I guess is kind of, you know, an important thing to sort of give this its own sort of identity rather than being sort of a totally disconnected sort of collection of, you know, events and performances and things.
Totally. We are a platform. And so all of the credit of anything you see happening interesting with Artery, it goes to the creators and the hosts and the artists that are bringing this to life. You know, we built a platform. And so we're responsible for the ones and zeros. But the spirit and the ideas and the ingenuity is coming from our community. So Artery is a platform, peer-to-peer platform, fully powered by these artists and these hosts. And so every expression of performance and intimacy that you see in Beirut or you see in Toronto or you see in Barrie or you see in Montreal is coming from our community. We just hope to be an enabling and an organizing space for that to happen more and more.
That was Salima Ibrahim, co-founder of Artery in Toronto. Find out more at artery.is. Now back in the studio, I'm joined by Broadcast Magazine's Peter White. You'll recognise him as a regular voice on Monocle 24 and within the pages of Monocle 2, as he's a regular expert on the international TV industry. And he's here now. Peter White, welcome to the programme.
Hello, Rob.
Now, this is good. We've got, for your column in this issue, you've got a piece of Chinese sort of fluffy dice that you might have hanging from your wing mirror. This is, our illustrator's kind of got the point of your column.
Absolutely.
This time, I won't say that they don't every time, but they've kind of hit pay dirt with this one.
Yeah.
So in this issue, you're talking about still really the gap left by Top Gear on the BBC schedules, and also what that means for BBC worldwide, because it was a big, not only was it a ratings juggernaut in the UK, but it earned a lot of money as a format for the BBC, right?
Absolutely, yeah. So obviously Top Gear's gone through a few changes, even more so this year and post-Clarkson. But yeah, it's a huge format internationally. It's BBC Worldwide, one of BBC Worldwide's biggest shows. It's sort of thought to make them over 50 million quid a year. So when all that was going on, BBC Worldwide were a little bit worried that if it sort of dropped off the schedules in the UK, then it would have a knock-on effect. They've spent the last few years trying to get local versions of the show. You know, they obviously sell the finished programme, the UK show, to many broadcasters in 200 territories. But actually, the real money is when you can actually get a local version. And they've over the years, they've had some success. There's been a few iterations in the States. There's a big show in France as well. But the one that they were really impressed with, which, as you say, with the Chinese dice, was when they could get it sold in China. That's when you can hit real pay dirt.
So Chinese Top Gear, so that is three presenters. That is the kind of features that you might find, Car and a readably priced car, all this kind of stuff that we enjoyed on Top Gear. What's the Chinese version like?
It's very similar. And actually, one of the things about Top Gear is that they do all of the same things. It might be slightly less, shall you say, Brexity with Clarkson and his guys, but you know, each individual territory takes it in a way. You know, you can imagine the French version being slightly more suave, and the American version is a little more rugged. But no, the Chinese version is relatively similar to the British show. Obviously, the local presenters are quite well known in their own way, so they have their own personalities. But yeah, all the same bits. Essentially, Top Gear is.
So you could almost watch it in another country without really needing subtitles, right?
Probably, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Certainly with the maybe not the banter between the hosts, but certainly all the car stuff. I mean, I think the thing is with formats like that, and particularly cars, is they don't really, you know, need language. It's yeah. it's about someone driving somewhere stupid or, you know, crashing somewhere. You know, how fast can you go? How, you know, stupid can the car be? So that's why those types of shows work really well, rather than something that is really high concept or, you know, a bit parochial. So they work as well as anywhere.
Now let's broaden it out, because you mentioned a few other programs as well, which kind of are similar to the theme. Carpool Karaoke is an interesting one. I mean, this is obviously part of James Corden's Late Show.
Yeah.
And now it's being sort of spooled off into something of its own. But he's not in it, but it's also on a funny platform. Tell us about how this kind of grew out of the show in the first place, Peter.
Absolutely. I mean, ironically, when we call it a car format, it is set in a car. But if you've ever seen it being filmed, the car isn't actually driving. It's being pulled along by by another vehicle, and they're just singing. So obviously, you couldn't drive and do what they do.
I thought James Corden was amazingly coordinated in order to be able to do that, right?
Yeah, absolutely. sing and dance and interview while he's driving. But no, you're right. So obviously, it started as a segment of his Late Late Show. A hugely successful segment, because he would get all his celebrity mates on, and he was pulling out, you know, the likes of Michelle Obama and Stevie Wonder. So they were getting these
not bad bookings.
Absolutely. And you know, he jokes, I think, early on that you know, he had to really lean on people that he knew, the One Direction guys and so forth. But actually, when people saw that it was, you know, really fun, it was lighthearted, it didn't take itself too seriously, he was getting some big names. So then they started pitching it as a sort of longer 30-minute version, and Apple Music picked it up. So Apple's been trying to get into the original TV game for a number of years. You know, they're obviously far behind the Netflixes and Amazons of the world, but they've got a lot of money and they've got a lot of eyeballs on there. You know, everyone's got Apple Music on there for iPhones and so forth. So they want to try and get original video on there. So they've created sort of multi-episode arc where, if you are an Apple Music subscriber, and that's everywhere in the world that you can get Apple Music, when it launches, they haven't given a date, but it's meant to be later this year, you'll be able to see it. And it's the first thing that they'll have done properly in that form. So no one's quite sure as to how successful it'll be or how many people will watch it.
And I wanted to take this, I think, talking about cars, let's put on our backless suede driving gloves and head into Alan Partridge territory, because one of the shows that you wrote about, Pete, is Paul Hollywood's Car Nation. This is the star of The Great British Bake Off, who went to Channel 4 in the UK and caused a bit of a furore. But it seems like the BBC are welcoming him back with surprisingly open arms for a new format.
Yeah, it's interesting. I think this deal may have been done before Paul. Obviously Paul wasn't involved, but before Channel 4 took Bake Off. And there was some rumours back when Clarkson and his gang left Top Gear, that Paul Hollywood would be one of the people to replace him. He's a big car nut. He's been on Top Gear many times. He's a, you know, he's a real bloke, isn't he? You know, he's that kind of sort of slightly racist, obnoxious elderly gentleman. So I don't think the BBC.
You should write more of his press releases. I really think you guys have got a great future together.
I'm sure Paul will be baking me a cake in celebration. But he's perfect for a car show. The BBC wants more Hollywood. You know, it probably doesn't hurt that, you know, him being on Channel 4, it's a bit of a two fingers to them that they've got Paul on the channel and doing this. It'll be interesting to see. As you say, it is a bit Partridge-y. We haven't seen it. It hasn't launched yet. But you sort of wonder, will it be a bit of a parody?
So the premise is he drives around a different European nation, or a nation, I think, and sort of defines that country by five cars that were produced in that country. So he goes to France, he goes to Germany. What does he say? He drives around in a big Mercedes-Benz. I think there are all sorts of
he takes a local
sad historical things that can be drawn from this that might not be that okay. I wonder where he's going to be going.
Certainly not now. I think it might have been commissioned pre-referendum. but yeah, it's very much the trip, but in a local car. And I think he's probably going to take a fancy car from each territory. He's going to take an old car from each place, and then maybe somewhere in the middle, you know, whatever the suburban housewives drives as well.
Yeah.
As a housewife's favourite. So yeah, it will be very much, you know, him going around the world. And again, they're doing this because it's a format that you can probably sell just about if there's enough in there. But equally, if you're, you know, in lots of different places, you hope those broadcasters might be interested, or certainly other places. You're looking at, it's a travel show through cars.
I know you haven't seen any rushes of this show. How do we rate Paul Hollywood's ability outside of the baking arena?
It'll be interesting to see whether Paul can hold his own show. There's been a few Paul Hollywood shows on some of the food channels. He's obviously done his own spin-offs by himself, but he hasn't really had a big show himself. Could he be the new Jeremy Clarkson?
A nation, nay, a world holds its breath. And let's just quickly tick off the last thing. This is Le Mans. It's called Racing is Everything. This is a show on Amazon Prime. Talk us through this one. Is this a simple doc about the 24-hour race?
Exactly. It's a very, very simple documentary. And Amazon's doing this very much on purpose. And they've got a couple of car things. They want to have programming around the Grand Tour. They spent a lot of money on that. No one really knows if it's success or not because they keep their numbers to themselves in the same way as Netflix does. But it got a lot of buzz at the time. We were all talking about it, and the television industry, was certainly really intrigued by Jeremy and doing it on another platform, a platform where they can swear and they've got a lot of money to blow shit up and all that sort of thing. So Amazon's basically seen that. They're going to do more of the Grand Tour, and they want more car programming or more sort of, motoring ideas to fit alongside them, just to, if you've watched the Grand Tour and you might also like, and they've got a couple of others, and I think they'll be doing more. I think Amazon's trying to try and build their non-scripted, they've obviously got some big scripted things, The Man in the High Castle and so forth, but they're trying to get more formats, more things that you might just stick on that don't feel so much as, I've got to really sort of sit and watch this. It's kind of a little bit more easy to watch programming.
Talking of easy to watch stuff, you're heading out to LA in a couple of days. This is an interesting thing. This is the sort of TV festival, I suppose, where all the shows that we are going to potentially be addicted to next year are played to the likes of you before. What are you looking forward to? What's the vibe like?
It'll be interesting. So this is all of the US networks, the likes of ABC, NBC, and CBS, and so forth. Last week or this week have announced all of their new shows for the forthcoming 12 months, and that tends to be about 40 shows. And then what happens is the week after, the sales divisions of all of those channels bring out all of the international buyers. So there's channels from all over the world. I'm going out with a bunch of UK buyers as well as the European guys and the Latin Americans, and everyone sits and watch telly for a week. It's a fantastic week. You're sort of schmoozed very well by the Hollywood studios, and they really want the buyers to pick up their shows. There's always some interesting stuff. You always watch a few sort of canned laughter American sitcoms that will never travel. There's often a lot of procedurals, as they're all looking for the next CSI or NCIS, the sort of case of the week by numbers types of shows. But there's often a few things that stand out.
When you're at film festivals or even just press screenings of things for movies, sometimes you can hear a pin drop. Sometimes people laughing in the wrong places. Sometimes people applauding things, booing things, walking out of things. What is the etiquette for these in these screening rooms, Pete?
Obviously you've got seasoned TV executives, so they're trying to, and they're also trying to keep their cards close to their chest because all of their rivals are sitting in the room, so they don't want to end up having to
the checkbook out
too much.
No, indeed, it's not the done thing. Right?
You do see in the comedies particularly, it's funny where people laugh. The Brits will laugh in one point, the Germans will laugh in another, and that's always quite curious. so to get the different reactions, but largely the reason the Hollywood studios get everyone out to LA to do this rather than doing it at a local level is everything looks a little bit better when it's on a Hollywood studio set, and there's all of the stars are around, the sun is shining, and you come back and sometimes you will have watched something at the LA screenings and you'll think, oh, I really enjoyed that. Oh, that was great. And you'll watch it, you're on a cold Tuesday, windy night at home, and you think, Christ, did I really enjoy that? and they're hoping that people will have bought it before they go and do that.
Before reality sets in.
Absolutely.
And then how do you chill out? Because it seems a bit of a waste going to LA to watch TV. I tend to come back with a bit of an embarrassing suntan when I come back to the office and say I've been interviewing people and working hard.
Yep.
Are you the same in the broadcast offices, or what's your sort of what's your alibi?
Well, they've already been joking that my place has got a very nice looking pool, but for me, I will spend a fair bit of time in Amoeba Records, trying to pick up as much stuff as I can there. And I do love an In-N-Out burger. A double-double animal style will always help.
We need to do this together next time.
Absolutely.
Pete. It's always a pleasure.
We'll do it on a road trip, Rob. It'll be a fun trip.
Big time. Pete White is the international editor of Broadcast Magazine. Thank you, as ever, for your time, Pete. And you can read Pete's story and all the other things we've talked about on today's show in issue 104 of Monocle, which is on all good newsstands now. Elsewhere in the culture section, find out about the German Gallerist and the multilingual magazine that you need to check out this month. That brings us to the end of today's show. You've been listening to Culture, where my producer was Holly Fisher. Join me again at the same time next week. For the time being, I've been Robert Bound, and thanks for tuning in.